Dharma, the incomparably profound and exquisite, is rarely met with, even in hundreds of thousands and millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. Today is day 5 of this Rohatsu Sesshin here in December 2017 at Mountain Gate in northern New Mexico. Rohatsu being the commemorative Sesshin of the Buddha's own, well, first ever Sesshin. And already on day 5, here we are, nearly. Well, we're definitely 2/3 of the way, at least, through day 5. So the important thing is to keep that energy, that depth going, that commitment going, letting go everything, everything, everything. And as usual, we will continue sharing Hakuin's Rohatsu exhortations. Hakuin being the Zen master, the Japanese Zen master, who resurrected the Rinzai Zen sect in Japan in the 18th century. This is his words on the fifth night. The master said, intensive training sessions known as Sesshin continue for periods of 80, 90, and 120 days. So we're doing the short form here. However, the level of practice does not depend necessarily on the length of the practice. And you'll hear more about this in a minute here. Since the goal of all those who take part is to clarify the great matter, while the Sesshin is in progress, no one leaves the temple gates and no one speaks unnecessarily. Practice is carried on with a spirit of dauntless, indomitable courage. In recent years, there was a man in a village near here who carved a stone image of Fudo the Immovable. He enshrined it beside a waterfall in the mountains of Yoshiwara. By the way, this is a story that, it's a true story apparently, that Hakuin repeats periodically with various different flourishes throughout a number of his writings. The man lived in a town on the other side of the mountain from where Shoinji was. That was Hakuin's temple. And he was one of the two most wealthy people in the village. Apparently there was a stream or a river running through the village right down the middle of it. And one of these men lived on one side and the other lived on the other side. Because of his wealth, one day when the villagers wanted to develop this park area and create an image to grace it, they asked him to financially support this carving of Fudo, one of the protectors. Spirit of indomitableness, immovable Fudo. And so he did, and in order to honor him, they placed him at the seat of honor at the celebration in which the figure was unveiled. The story continues. He enshrined it beside a waterfall in the mountains of Yoshiwara. One day, as he was watching the water tumbling down the cliffside, his gaze fixed on the bubbles that formed in the pool at the foot of the falls. Some moved over the water for a foot or so before disappearing, some for 2 or 3 feet, and some continued floating 2 or 3 yards. Watching their progress, the man's past karma enabled him to perceive the impermanence of worldly existence. The realization shook him to the marrow of his being. He now found it impossible to find peace within himself. There he was at the celebration, the villagers singing and celebrating and enjoying their sake and their special meals at the foot of the waterfall. And suddenly it all went flat for him. He realized some people die young, some people die in middle age, Some people die older, but everyone dies, including himself. And so he left the celebration and went back to his home. And on the way, he heard something. He chanced to hear a man recite a passage from the Dharma words of priest Takasui. Courageous beings attain Buddhahood in a single instant of thought. Lax and indolent beings take 3 long kalpas to attain nirvana. So a great burning determination rose in him. He entered the bathing room and shut the door behind him. There was a guest area in his home, and that was where this particular bathroom was. And a Japanese bathroom is not the same as an American or a Western bathroom. It is the room where the Japanese bath is, and it's considered one of the sacred places in a temple, by the way, and one of the others being the Zendo. And it's a place of reverence and a place to compose oneself in peace and settledness and to search for your very origins. So a great burning determination rose in him, and he entered the bathing room, shut the door behind him. Sitting down, he straightened his spine, clenched his fists, opened his eyes wide, and began doing zazen with great determination. Delusory thoughts flew thick and fast through his mind. The obstructions of the demon realms rose up to confuse him. But because he threw himself body and soul into the great Dharma battle, he finally severed life at the roots and entered into the formless realm of deep samadhi. At first light, hearing the sparrows chirping around outside the building, he found that his body had completely disappeared. Suddenly, he saw his eyeballs pop from their sockets and fall to the ground. He felt the pain of his fingernails gouging into the palms of his hands and realized his eyes were back in their proper place. He rose from his cushion and began to walk about. He continued to practice in the same manner for 3 nights. On the 3rd night, when daybreak came, and he got up to wash his face, he noticed that the trees in the garden were now somehow totally different. He consulted the priest of a nearby temple about it, but the priest was unable to provide any answers. He then decided to come and see me. He set out for Shoinji in Palanquin. That's how people of wealth traveled in those days. Now, palanquin is, you can call it a carrying chair. And it's carried by 4 strong men who will even run with it if it needs to be moved speedily. And so he got his palanquin set up, hopped in, and it was raised on the shoulders of these men, and off they went. And of course they had to go over this pass in order to get to Ohara, where Shoinji was. And at the top of the pass, they paused. He paused to allow the men to get a little bit of a rest. And from there, the view apparently was quite spectacular. Upon reaching the high pass at Sata, the splendid prospect of the ocean at Koura came into view far below. At that instant, he knew beyond any doubt that what he had grasped was the truth, that plants and trees and the great earth all attain Buddhahood. Plants, trees, and the great earth all attain Buddhahood. Proceeding to my temple, he passed through the fires of my forge and subsequently penetrated a number of koan barriers. Passed through the fires of my forge, that meant that he came to Sanzen. There's a saying in the Katoshu, or not the Katoshu, in the Zenrinkushu, the sayings of the history of Zen, combinations of fragments of Chinese poetry as well as expressions of Zen masters. How can pure gold be realized without going again and again through the Master's Forge. That pure gold, of course, is our realization, our understanding of the deep and profound truth of reality. That profound truth, which when deeply enough realized, is incalculably freeing. Proceeding to my temple, he passed through the fires of my forge and subsequently penetrated a number of koan barriers. He was an ordinary man with no prior knowledge of Zen practice whatsoever. Yet, in just two or three short nights, he achieved a realization. The great victory he gained in the struggle against illusory thought was the result of courageous determination and single-minded resolve. It wasn't the result of striving, driving, fixating. It was a result of knowing that he had to find some resolution to this deep angst that had struck him when he watched the waterfall. And it was because of his advanced age and the recognition that he might not have long in which to comprehend it that gave him the courage to face whatever he had to face in the process of opening to that liberating truth. And that's why he was able to do it in such a short time, despite the fact that he had had no prior knowledge of Zazen. And it's the same for us. What makes a difference in our practice is our level of determination and commitment, not the grit with which we practice, but the level of determination, the need to know, the recognition that this is the only way that we can ultimately become free. That not to open to this deep truth was to spin around endlessly in the world of samsara, pain and suffering, periods of happiness followed by pain and suffering. Periods of happiness followed by pain and suffering endlessly unless we choose to get off that track. Here we are in day 5 of Zazen. Bring forth even greater determination to open to this profound liberating truth. Determination, faith that you can realize it, and a commitment to open to this perplexity that is the source of our need to know. If this is deep enough, it won't take long. But again, be warned. We're going through a lot of things along the way. In order to become free, we need to see where we're caught, recognize it, comprehend it, see through it, let it go. And in that, we gain a measure of freedom. But given that we have lifetimes of conditioning, of assumptions, of judgments, of ideas, particularly ideas of who we are, it is not normally instantaneous. And even if, like this man, it only takes 3 days and nights to have an initial Kensho experience, there is further and deeper awakening that we must undergo in order to truly be free. A single Kensho, while it may feel great at the time and give us some space in our lives If we stop there, it's an enormous waste. The great victory he gained in the struggle against illusory thought was a result of courageous determination and single-minded resolve. How can you, full-fledged Zen monks, fail to generate the same fierce and dauntless spirit? And that is Hakuin on the fifth night of Rahatsu Sesshin at Shoinji in Japan. And Shoinji still exists. Not only does it still exist, people still sit Zazen there. And it is possible to go and visit and sit Zazen in that very same Zendo that Hakuin himself sat in. It's an incredibly powerful place. So is this one you're sitting in right now. So now we will continue with the letters of Dahui, Dahui Zongao, the Chinese Chan master of the 11th century. And this is from the letters of Dahui part two. And I'm not quite sure why they're divided into part one and part two. I'm going to have to get in touch with the translator and find out what this really means. But at the moment, it's up in the air. This is chapter 28, Dahui's letter to Xia Yongxi, also named Zihong. Thank you for your letter. You write, quote, "If our paths accord, we may be as far apart as heaven and earth, but it's as though we're together. If our intentions differ, we may be standing face to face, but we're as far apart as Chu and Yue," close quote. Chu and Yue apparently were ancient provinces in China that were quite far distant. And this is a deep truth. Mind knows no barriers. We can box it in by erecting ideas about ourselves and things, judgments, assumptions. But mind is infinite. And when people are open in mind, truly open, truly let go enough, communication is as close as if they were standing next to each other. But again, of course, as he says, if two people are not of that same openness, then they can be standing next together and still misunderstanding, miscommunication will be rampant. So this is a rather deep understanding that this man wrote to Dahui. "How apt these words are," he writes. "This is truly a mystery inexpressible in words. Even before you conceived of writing to me and dusted off your paper, you'd already presented it to me with both hands. Why need you wait until you attain the state of fortitude or the state of a stage of ultimate before meeting me?" These are stages conceived of as part of the Bodhisattva path. There's a koan: when the horses in such and such a province eat grain, the cows in another province, their stomachs are full. Expresses the same understanding. It's a koan, but you're not going to pass it by talking about it like that. "The truth of the matter is mutually understood by all enlightened beings without a single word being said, but with deluded people it cannot be discussed. Yanping is one of the most pleasant areas in the province of Min." Apparently this man is from Yanping. "If you skillfully regulate your own mind and are not controlled by the workings of adverse circumstances, then you are truly a liberated person." If you skillfully regulate your own mind and are not controlled by the workings of adverse circumstances, how many of us can respond freely to changes of schedule, to sudden things interrupting our life, that when we are truly free, these are not a problem. We're able to turn on a dime and respond instantly to whatever the new circumstances are. But if we're fixed in an idea of what we think we need and who we think we are, it's like wearing a straitjacket and trying to play the piano in spite of it. A straitjacket, if you've ever seen one, is a jacket with extremely long sleeves that the person's arms are placed in front of them, crossed in front of them, and then those sleeves are wrapped around to the back. So you're basically immovable. You can't do a thing with your hands. It's a way of containing unruly mental health patients. I don't know if they're even still used anymore, but I do know that at one point when we were living in Burma, where things were anything but regular, this was right after General Ne Win had taken over, and people in the diplomatic corps, some of them were accustomed to much fancier places to live, much more ample places to live. Rangoon was basically going down the drains. People of any profession were fleeing to the degree that they could, and garbage was collecting in the streets until Ne Win made the garbage collectors, who were the untouchable folks, Indians in Burma, honorary citizens of India, or honorary citizens of Burma, so that they could remain and be honored and keep their jobs and still work. They were dumping onions in the river, rotting onions in the river upstream, because the whole transportation system got completely mucked up. They couldn't even get them down to Rangoon, Yangon, the capital, so people didn't have an abundance of food there or anywhere else in Burma. And when you couple that with the long period of the rains, it rained steadily on and off all day, to the point where everyone always carried an umbrella with them. You never came in and got dry. You had to iron your clothes in order to get them dry. It was an interesting experience, ironing underwear to get your underwear dry, because it wouldn't dry any other way. And this was not what people who had been posted to Paris or Bonn or London expected to have to deal with. And there was a man at the embassy. He was actually the head of one of the divisions of the embassy. And eventually, after 4 years of living in those conditions, he cracked and had to be escorted home in a straitjacket, is what we were told. This was a man who, shortly before that, we had traveled with. The time we were living in Mandalay, far away from Rangoon, and a very different climate. It was quite hot, 110, 115 degrees every day, day and night, until the rains, winds shifted, and then suddenly it plunged down to 40 degrees, which was quite a shock. The first year that happened, it was unexpected. But we went traveling with this man and his wife, and we went to the Shan states. Burma is a group of states, as the United States is. It's the Union of Burma. And the ethnic Burmans live in the lowlands in the central area, and then all around in the mountains live different ethnic groups. And the Shan are one of the ethnic groups, and within the Shan state there were many other subgroups, all with fascinating, colorful dress. And it was a wonderful experience to live there. At any rate, we went to the Shan state, to the capital of the Shan state, Tangji, and where it was always interesting. There was a market, a very colorful market. There actually, by the time we got there, an enterprising man had established a little hotel. He had real furniture, And he even served a breakfast of eggs. But our friend at the embassy just about lost it because there was no ketchup. Here we are in the remote mountains of Southeast Asia, and he can't live without ketchup. This is a rather major example of the condition of most people in the world today in particular. We are fixed in our ideas of what we think we need. And when we don't get those needs met, there's a great deal of pain and suffering. And yet those fixed ideas of what we need are just that. They're just ideas. And the most fixed idea that is the most difficult and the most confining is that of a self-image. This idea that we are this person who has particular qualities, a particular history, and because of that history, fears and joys and assumptions about our power, about our role in life, about our status in society, and all the rest. And to come to awakening is to allow ourselves to see through these ideas into the profound truth of who we really are. Those ideas are stories. They're conditioning. They're not real. So if they're not real, then who are we? And this is the source of our perplexity. It may come in different formats for different people. For myself, it was one of, even as a child, having the sense that there was something beyond what I could grasp with my hands or with my mind at the time that was important to return to live from once more. For other people, it's, why is there pain and suffering in this world? There's lots of different wordings to this really wordless perplexity that is the source of why we're sitting here together in this little zendo in northern New Mexico on this fifth day of Sesshin. And it has great power to liberate us. This is what we do with the practice. Our fundamental Rinzai practice is the extended out-breath called Sesokan, where we simply tune in to the bodily experience of breathing out and bring that breath further out at the bottom instead of bringing back right away. Over and over again, we do this when we're seated on the cushion. What it does is it requires us to drop everything else in our mind in order to focus on the bodily experience. And over time, our focus gets honed, sharpened. At the same time, there's an expansion of awareness, which is also very, very important. And the important aspect as well, of course, as was just mentioned, is that in extending that out breath, we have to let other things go. And we begin to train ourselves in letting go. And it becomes easier as a result of that practice on the cushion to not be quite as caught in our daily life. Now, there's a further dimension to this practice, and that is as we are extending the out breath, we're reaching through the out breath, propelled by this, whatever this fundamental perplexity is. And it is beyond words. This is vital. We cannot think our way to it. There's a disconnect between words and the reality. Words are a tool. They're not the reality. So when you combine this on the cushion, and then off the cushion, you keep that perplexity sort of running underground, and the awareness expanding. You let go of the breath, because if you're in the midst of activity, it's not going to work. And besides that, it's going to produce a rather major barrier to you for being awareness, aware. And awareness is vital. There was a great Chinese Zen master who was asked by a student, if there's one word that defines practice, what is this most important word? And he picked up his brush and he wrote the character for attention. And the monk said, okay, what else? And again, the master wrote the character for attention. And the monk said, so what does attention mean? What do you mean, attention? And the master said, attention means attention. When we pay utter attention to whatever we're doing, the awareness is there. We're doing whatever we're doing without the barrier of ideas about it, of thoughts about it. There is just the bare awareness of doing whatever it is doing. There's nobody then doing whatever is being done. And this is a very vital aspect of practice. The two combined will bring you to awakening. Not only that, but as you're extending the out-breath, particularly if you've got a history that involves some kind of trauma, some aspect of feeling will come up. It may simply be a feeling of being blocked. Like there's a great massive boulder somewhere stuck in your chest, so you can't get that breath out. If something like that takes place, then you tune in to the energy of that mythical boulder and stay present with that. And when you're present sufficiently, you'll be able, right in the midst of that, to extend the out-breath far deep. It's as if the boulder simply dissolves. Now, of course, if you've got some seriously traumatic history, it's important also to work with a therapist who understands trauma and also understands meditation. And the two combined can be incredibly effective in helping one liberate oneself. So, continuing with Dawei's letter to Xia Yunxi. If you skillfully regulate your own mind and are not controlled by the workings of adverse circumstances, then you are truly a liberated person. Such people themselves control the workings of the circumstances around them and are vigorous and lively throughout the day. This sounds a little odd, but when you don't need to control according to your ideas of how things ought to be, what goes on in your life, when instead you flow with the circumstances, with awareness, clarity, then your innate wisdom can come forth and flexibility is there to respond to circumstances rather than to react to them. And as you do that, it influences everything around you, people and things. And an example of this that you've heard before is when Harada Rishi was a monk in training. He was a senior monk. He was one of the head monks at Shofukuji in Japan, in Kobe. And one day he took a work detail outside the inner gate of the temple. They were still in temple grounds. And at the time, there was a group of homeless people, and yes, there are homeless people in Japan, who were living on the temple grounds, not within the inner areas, but on the outer grounds. And they felt that somehow the temple was cheating him out of water or something. And the leader of these people was a man who, the person who was in that work party, who described it to me, said, appeared to be no stranger to violence. And he came and he stuck his face right into the face of Adaroshi and started screaming at him, furious about this issue with the water. And Adaroshi just got more and more quiet inside, paid utter attention to the man. He didn't check out, and he didn't leave. He was there present, fully present with this man. And when we are fully present with somebody like that, and of course, we have to qualify the circumstances that it wasn't a seriously dangerous situation. It was dangerous enough, but there were other people around. And in fact, the person that told me about it said he hung onto his shovel, and just in case he needed to whack the guy if he took a swing at Hadaroshi. And the result of Hadaroshi simply quieting down inwardly and yet staying present with this man affected the man himself, and the man began to de-escalate and quiet down. And then they were able to talk quietly, and the man went away, and I don't know if the problem was solved, but certainly it was temporarily solved at least. And this all took place simply because Hadaroshi was free enough at the time that he was able to simply be present with this man's serious anger, rage really, and not be affected by it. If you skillfully regulate your own mind and are not controlled by the workings of adverse circumstances, then you are truly a liberated person. Such people themselves control the workings of the circumstances around them and are vigorous and lively throughout the day. They can be neither confined nor provoked. Should you attain a direct understanding of this, then everything that obstructs you will quite naturally disappear. And this is one of the byproducts of having a deep enough awakening experience or series of awakening experiences. An ancient master said, quote, the Buddha preached the various teachings to liberate all minds. In me there is no trace of mind, so what use have I of any teachings? Close quote. Lan Rong said, quote, when the mind functions without tension, there is no tension in no mind. Roundabout talk labors under names and forms. Straight talk has no encumbrances. When functioning at ease in no mind, one is at ease in no mind, however long one functions. The no mind I speak of is no different than mind. This state of mind applies not only to Lan Ring, but to you and me as well. Its contents cannot be taken hold of and shown to others. This is what I meant when I wrote that, quote, without a single word being said, it is mutually understood. This is deep teaching. May it inspire you to enter a deep stage of letting go yourself and not to stop there, to continue dropping deeply within, searching for what it is, that perplexity, or I should say what created that perplexity that brought you to practice to begin with. We have 3 more days in Sesshin. The final night, we can sit all night, and we'll sit formally at least for some hours after the end of what is normally the formal sitting schedule other nights. Don't let up in your work. On the Zendo door, there's a plaque that was written in kanji by Harada Shororoshi. It says, great effort without fail will bring about great light. Great effort without fail will bring about great light. And that great effort is not the tooth gritting, fingernails digging into palms type of effort. It's the profound sinking deep within, utterly quiet. On and on, deeper and deeper and deeper. As Hakuin would say, if you practice like this, you cannot fail to come to awakening any more than you can touch the ground when you reach down at your feet. Thank you for listening. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.